The content of today's program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, here is the current issue of Indie Week, read by John Federson from the North Carolina Reading Service. And this week's issue, dated August the 12th, 2020. And a hearty thank you to our musicians today. From Jim and Julie's Home Cleaning Service Vacuum Cleaner Ensemble. That's a change, playing all of this music on specially tuned vacuum cleaners. Well done. We open today's issue, this week's issue, with Voices, this one by Jonathan Weiler, who is a professor of global studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Left Ahead. Last month, to even less fanfare than in a typical election year, the Democratic Party released its 2020 platform. Platforms are generally seen as a sideshow, documents that read more like florid wish lists than serious blueprints for governance. And insofar as broken promises, think of the elder Bush's no new taxes pledge in 1988, tend to draw more media attention and partisan ire than fulfilled ones do. It's easy to dismiss platforms' importance. But political scientists who study them argue they are more relevant than conventional wisdom suggests. They reveal the balance of forces between factions within a political party and provide a decent guide, with plenty of caveats, to how that party will try to govern over the next 4 years if it assumes power. Joe Biden may be a moderate, but the platform he's running on includes a long list of progressive goals and language. In part, that's a product of the joint task force that the Biden and Sanders campaign formed to forge shared approaches to major policy areas. Of course, Biden is free to pick and choose which parts of the platform he will embrace, ignore, or actively reject. But it would be wrong to entirely dismiss the document as a guide to what goals a Biden presidency might pursue. One indication of the progressive influence on the platform comes in the introduction. For the first time, the Democratic Party includes a land acknowledgement, noting that the land on which drafters convened was, quote, stewarded through many centuries by the ancestors and descendants of tribal nations, and that our country was built on indigenous homelands. Among the unsurprising but notable outcomes the platform says it is committed to are universal health coverage, vigorous action to reverse climate change, reinstating the full power of the Voting Rights Act, restoration of, quote, humanity and decency to our immigration system, and championing LGBTQ and disability rights. Reflecting the increasing impact of activists from movements like Black Lives Matter and the extraordinary swell of protests since the killing of George Floyd, the section of this year's platform devoted to reforming criminal justice, is more than three times longer than it was in 2016. The phrase police brutality did not appear in the 2016 platform, despite the fact that BLM had already emerged as a major force in the wake of the killings of Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, Philando Castile, and others. This year, drafters opined that, quote, police brutality is a stain on the soul of our nation. More broadly, the platform repeatedly highlights racial and other inequities as fundamental obstacles to a more just America and outlines approaches for remedying these inequities. The document is replete with specific policy proposals, including a $15 minimum wage, 12 weeks of federally mandated paid family leave, which is 12 weeks more than the current federal mandate, the provision of 500,000 EV charging stations around the country, statehood for Washington, D.C., and tuition-free public colleges and universities for students whose families earn less than $125,000 annually. The platform is not, however, a giveaway to Sanders, Warren, or progressive activists more broadly. The phrase Medicare for All appears just once to acknowledge that there are people in the party who support it. Instead, the path to universal health care will pass through a more robust Obamacare, including a public option. There is no call to abolish ICE or defund the police. The Green New Deal is nowhere to be found. Not all of the platform's promises will become law, of course. Even if Democrats control the legislative and executive branch next year, let us pray, the new administration will prioritize some of these items more than others. It'll make compromises. It will be subject to lobbying influences that oppose much of what the platform calls for. The pandemic, a topic the platform also devotes a lot of attention to, and the economic fallout from it may well constrain a Biden administration. But with all those caveats, it's not fanciful to hope that a Biden presidency, while it will surely disappoint in myriad ways, will pursue a range of progressive goals and strive to act on much of the platform. How successful it will be is another matter. Next comes an op-ed column by two PhD students in anthropology at UNC, Kayla Kochleisher and Julio Gutierrez. Debunking Disaster, Six Myths About Reopening UNC Chapel Hill. On Monday, August 10, UNC Chapel Hill will reopen its campus for the 2021 academic year. Despite widespread criticism from students, staff, and faculty, the UNC Board of Governors has reaffirmed its commitment to a plan based mostly on in-person instruction. They have claimed there are no other options. Here are six myths about the university's reopening. 1. Reopening UNC will be safe because everyone will abide by the Carolina Together community standards. According to a survey conducted by Gillings School of Global Public Health and the Office of Institutional Research and Assessment, only 52% of undergraduate students at UNC said they were extremely likely to adhere to physical distancing requirements on campus. An additional 28% responded they are extremely or somewhat likely to go to parties or other large campus gatherings. While training over the summer, dozens of student athletes, coaches, and staff in the athletic department tested positive in a cluster of COVID-19. Such outbreaks of the coronavirus amongst UNC undergrad students and campus staff are likely to continue occurring once UNC's campus reopens and students return to residential halls. 2. UNC does not have the financial capacity to go all online. In the past 2 decades, UNC system universities have undergone a process of corporatization by extending their sources of revenue through different investments. Most have endowment funds consisting of a diversified set of assets. According to the 2019 annual report of the UNC Investment Fund, cited in a petition drafted by graduate workers, UNC has a total of $434 million in cash and equivalents and more than $6 million in assets undesignated and without donor restriction. This is more than 3 times the amount raised in tuition in fees in 2019. That's $146 million, according to the same report. The point of having such a substantial amount of liquid resources must be, at least in part, to deal with unforeseen emergencies. If protecting students and workers from a deadly pandemic is not a worthy enough reason to draw on these, we wonder what these resources are for. 3. Campus workers want UNC to reopen because they will be able to keep their jobs. An all-online fall semester at UNC would not necessitate the termination of all campus employees. In the event of a severe outbreak, an indefinite shutdown of the university system after beginning in-person operations may actually endanger more jobs than the alternative. Many campus workers at UNC Chapel Hill have been actively involved in the Save Jobs, Save Lives campaign begun by members of the UE150. These essential frontline workers have made unanswered demands for protections, such as increased availability of personal protective equipment, hazard pay, and expanded sick leave. At a town hall meeting about COVID-19 held by the workers of the UNC system on August 16th, UE 150 Vice President Sekia Royal reminded listeners that the unjust treatment of campus workers is a form of institutional racism. Royal stated that campus workers are disproportionately black and Latinx. The deaths due to COVID-19 have been disproportionately black and Latinx workers, mostly due to the exposure we get at work or traveling to work. Number four, reopening UNC will save local communities from an economic disaster. A potential decrease in the level of economic activity generated by students and staff in the surrounding community has been a major argument in favor of in-person campus operations. The effects of such losses do not compare to the widespread impacts of an outbreak and its ramifications. The influx of students and personnel into the local community creates a higher risk for a severe COVID-19 outbreak, which could necessitate another round of business closures and increased unemployment. The impacts of this scenario would be felt most intensely by households with limited or no access to health care, who are already disproportionately affected by the pandemic. While economic distress is inevitable, the university system has the potential to mitigate these effects by protecting students, staff, and the surrounding community. Next, UNC is choosing in-person instruction because not everyone in the state has access to high-speed internet. While access to high-speed internet is indeed a major obstacle for remote learning, universities in the UNC system have the ability to allocate a portion of their resources to the improvement of internet infrastructure in underserved areas of North Carolina. They also have the capacity to directly provide the necessary technology to students in need. The high fees charged by UNC to run campus facilities that will not operate during the emergency could be allocated to such endeavors. Given the urgency of this situation and the benefits of such services for students, building a better remote learning infrastructure could become a concerted focus of donor contributions. Finally, holding classes in person will provide students with the college experience. There is no viable option where students get a normal educational or social experience under the conditions of an ongoing global pandemic. Socially distanced mask-to-mask instruction is a poor imitation of a typical classroom setting. Masks present a practical barrier to communication by muffling instructors and students' voices. For hearing-impaired students, face coverings pose an additional hurdle to interpreting speech. Small group discussions of class material and hands-on activities will be made difficult by social distancing requirements. The mode of instruction for classes will be impacted by individual cases of COVID-19. The hybridization of in-person classes will become increasingly necessary as more students are infected with or exposed to COVID-19 and subsequently required to attend classes virtually. If North Carolina continues on its current trajectory, rising cases of COVID-19 will almost certainly necessitate that the UNC system go all online during the fall semester. According to the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, 1,167 people were hospitalized and 2,050 had died in North Carolina due to COVID-19 as of August the 5th. The lives of UNC students, instructors, and campus workers will be at an increased risk due to on-campus operations when compared to an all-online scenario. We must combat these pervasive myths about the safety and necessity of reopening UNC's campus and work to protect the lives of Orange County residents and all those in the UNC community. Now, ordinarily, this column is called The Good, the Bad, and the Awful, and this week we've got The Weird, the Bad, and the Awful, and for weird, earthquake. We've seen Kanye West run for president. We've seen murder hornets. We've seen Trump try to ban TikTok. We've seen NASCAR ban the Confederate flag. This year's been full of unexpected news. And honestly, Sunday's 5.1 magnitude earthquake, despite being the state's largest for over a century, might not even crack the list of the top five weirdest moments of 2020. The aftershocks were felt as far away as Atlanta, but the epicenter was right around the northern North Carolina town of Sparta. WRAL got to work reporting on the quake by bringing viewers live video from Sparta in Greece. Oops. In a sign of how truly bizarre 2020 has been. That's arguably not even the biggest North Carolina weather reporting blunder in the past week. Remember when the Weather Channel called Ocracoke Island Corn Crake Island? For the bad award, UNC sorority members, last Tuesday night, two dozen students were filmed leaving a house near UNC campus to head to a party. None of the women, who seemed to be a part of UNC's Chi Omega sorority, were wearing masks, and they were all standing side by side rather than social distancing. It's a frustrating but predictable result of recalling students back to campus for fall classes. A July survey published by the university found that while 84% of surveyed undergrad students said they were likely to wear face masks on campus, only 52% they were extremely likely to adhere to physical distancing requirements on campus. Worse still, 28% said they were likely to attend some sort of party or large campus gathering. These actions put people's lives in danger, from students to university employees to business owners and residents in college towns across the state. And for the awful award is given to the piecemeal COVID-19 response. Of course, the fact that those students were made to return to campus at all speaks to a larger issue with our country's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. The United States' response to COVID-19 has been all over the place, and it looks abysmal when you look at how other countries fought the virus. New Zealand, for example, hasn't seen a new COVID-19 case from an unknown local source in over 100 days, thanks to a strict nationwide lockdown enacted early in the pandemic by Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. By contrast, the responsibility for tackling the pandemic here has been left up to state and local governments. It's encouraging to see states like North Carolina making the hard choice to extend lockdown measures or cancel beloved events like the state fair. But the lack of a coordinated national strategy has led to a world-leading 5.3 million cases here in the United States. Now to a news column, Thomas E. McDonald from Durham, Housing Crisis. For this generation of black folk, gentrification is just another name for the urban renewal programs that displaced black-owned homes and businesses more than 50 years ago. Today, black people in Durham are being forced to leave a city where they have lived and worked for decades. They can no longer afford to live in a place where home costs and property taxes are soaring. The Black Lives Matter signs planted on the front lawns of Durham's white homeowners are admirable, but for some observers, the displacement of black families from their homes is a fundamental example of how black lives really don't matter in America. Residents of the historically black Bragtown neighborhood in North Durham, where major developments are poised to take place, understand the embittered observation of the character Turnbow in August Wilson's play Jitney, about the urban renewal that raised Pittsburgh's Hill District in the 1970s. Quote, "They won't be satisfied until they tear the whole goddamn neighborhood down." On March 9th, members of the Bragtown Community Association, some with roots in the neighborhood dating back to the end of slavery, started an online petition to preserve their neighborhoods. That fight will reach a crescendo at 5:30 p.m. Tuesday night, when the city's planning commission will vote on proposed developments. The community association, chaired by longtime residents Vanessa Mason Edwards and Constance Wright, resorted to the petition after 6 months of working to ensure that the developments are in line with their recommendations for affordable housing, community support, public safety, and environmental protections. They point to a proposed development of 900 new homes along Danube Lane, where the builders have agreed to construct 20 affordable housing units. Mason Edwards said, "At first they said they would build 10 affordable homes. Then they said 20. 10 was a slap in the face." The community is also asking the Planning Commission members and city leaders to heed the recommendations made last month by Durham Racial Equity Task Force members, who said that the city should clarify the intended beneficiaries of his policies, explore who will benefit and who is most burdened, and ensure community members are engaged in all aspects of any given project. John Killeen, the director of the nonprofit DataWorks, found that in 2010, nearly 70% of home sale prices in Bragtown were affordable to residents. In 2018, only 47% were able to afford a home in the community. Killeen notes that the costlier homes have led to higher taxes and the threat of displacement. Quote, he notes, quote, as of April 2020, Bragtown was the location of 270 of the 3,200 tax-delinquent properties in Durham County. He also points out that Bragtown residents make up more than 8% of the county's total tax-delinquent properties. Killeen says the housing crisis in Bragtown has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. The community is within a zip code that, in February, had the county's highest caseload, 29 per 1,000 people. Nearly 60% of community members work in essential job sectors such as healthcare, education, retail, and food service. Bragtown Community Association Vice Chair Wright owns a bungalow in Bluefield that's adorned with potted plants and ornamental trees. She says, it's so greedy the way they do everything. My taxes pay for just as much. It may not be as high, but it's high for me. Community Association member Celeste Ritchie points to a feel-good spiel about Durham that includes, quote, hearing about all kinds of housing available, but it's never affordable housing. I wonder about a future where no one who makes a certain amount of money gets to live in Durham anymore. The proposed increase from 10 to 20 homes falls short of the Community Association's recommendation that developers commit to making at least 50% of homes affordable for Bragtown residents, meaning rent or a mortgage of $850 a month or less. Another association member, Billy D., says, quote, the developers chose not to engage in a collaborative discussion and did not make substantive changes to their proposal, so the community is requesting that planning commissioners and city council members vote no on the proposals as they currently stand. Bragtown stretches north to Hebron Road and south to I-85 along Roxborough Road. The community is largely populated by essential workers and retirees on fixed incomes, teachers, bus drivers, restaurant employees, and construction workers. Many of the long-time residents purchased their homes in the 1960s and 70s for well less than $100,000. Now, with the refurbishing and flipping of old homes for more $200,000, long-time residents worry about losing their homes because of exponential increases in property taxes. Bragtown was settled just after emancipation by former enslaved people whose forced labor reaped fortunes for the owners of the Stagville Plantation, less than 10 miles away. At slavery's end, the freed men and women followed the railroad tracks and settled in what was then a heavily wooded area. They built homes. They worked as farmers, sharecroppers, and grew vegetable gardens to sustain their families. Today, the area is often cast as a troubled community because of deadly gun violence. But no one talks about the community garden club headed up by an octogenarian resident. The community's parents appreciate the new playground equipment at the Lakeview Park. Free lunches have been provided to children all summer at the Lakeview School. Last month, the city approved the creation of a mural at the park and library by local and regional artists. Community Association member Stephanie Bigelow, it's all part of the effort to revitalize and bring a positive light to the community. Mason Evans says a sense of collective purpose and kinship infuses the community. She remembers coming of age there in the 1960s when public schools desegregated and a white school teacher asked her third grade class what they wanted to be when they grew up. One white child announced he wanted to grow up and become a cop so that he could, quote, beat niggers. Mason Evans says that child is a Durham cop now. There's a cemetery on Old Oxford Road that contains the remains of people who lived and died in the 1800s. Evans pointed to the fenced-in grave markers of whites who were buried next to the footstool-sized grave markers of those they enslaved. She says, it's as if they wanted their slaves to serve them in heaven, if that's where they ended up. Now the threat of being displaced or losing their community identity has opened unhealed wounds among the Bragg-Town residents and no small amount of frustration with what feels like an invasion. Mason Edwards said, predatory buyers are calling on the phone. They want to buy your house at the price what it was built for, $48,000 or $50,000, not the price that it's worth. Now to the cover story from Indie Week of August 12th, Troubled Family. This is a long article about the restaurant Vida Mander. During Raleigh's Black Lives Matter uprisings in late May, protesters smashed Brewery Bavana's storefront window. In response, the downtown icon, already shuttered by the effects of COVID-19 pandemic, posted a statement to social media stating that the restaurant's window was just a piece of property. Black lives mattered more. The post, polished and seemingly harmless, touched off a dramatic series of events that led first to an outpouring of first-hand accounts from employees alleging misconduct at the restaurant and its longer-standing counterpart, Vida Manda. This was followed by a quick succession of devastating reports of mistreatment of employees on WRAL and in the News and Observer. Parenthesis. At the time, the Indy came in for criticism, too, for failing to follow up on a tip a year earlier about conditions at these restaurants. The public reckoning led to management departures from the restaurant, including co-owner and general manager Van Nolintha. The restaurant announced that Nolintha's sister, Van Visa, who co-owns both restaurants, and Patrick Woodson, who co-owns Brewery Bavana, would forge a new way forward. There would also be a search for a new CEO and a third-party investigation into the allegations. Since that time, Indie Week has spoken to 16 current and former employees of Vida Mander and Brewery Bavana, in addition to numerous people close to the situation. Many employees spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear of losing their jobs or being blacklisted in Raleigh's restaurant industry. They tell a story about a workplace in which vulnerability was coerced by Nolintha and those loyal to him. This company value, employees say, made the prominent Raleigh restaurants uniquely susceptible to sexual misconduct and the emotional manipulation of employees. Former bartender Nicole Bivens wrote on Instagram on June 7th, "Know the Nolinthas have always fostered a culture of vulnerability, and Van Nolintha and Jordan Hester have both abused that trait with their staff." What follows is an in-depth report of the inner workings of Vida Mander and Brewery Bavana as recounted by employees who experienced the restaurant's cult-like environment. Two separate stories set the stage. One details serious allegations against one of the restaurant's most prominent employees, former beverage director Jordan Hester, while the other outlines the national context of a restaurant reckoning like this one. Before the events of May, the two Laotian-influenced establishments had come to be known in the Triangle for their empathy and civic engagement in fraught times. That reputation was coupled with local and national renown for their food, beer, service, bookstore, and floral arts. The May 31st Brewery Bavana Instagram post read, "We have come to learn that the act of speaking out is crucial to what it means to be an ally." This drew a blunt reply in the comments from Sarah Dye, a former employee. Quote, "When are you going to address the sexual abuse that also happens in your establishment?" Commenting on Nolintha's post was quickly disabled, but not before an open letter from the employees, "Keep Vida Mander Accountable," began circulating, describing a racist incident that occurred earlier this year. The document was joined by a flurry of social media posts from employees, including alleging sexual harassment by Nolintha and the restaurant's beverage director, Jordan Hester. Hester's lawyer did not return repeated calls from Indy. The racist incident occurred in early February when Jibril Parks, La Bidamanda server, was nearing the end of a shift. Manager Kate Shields stopped Parks to point out a table that needed clearing. He was, she said, her slave. Parks is black. Both reported the interaction to other managers. Shields, who did not want to speak on the record to the Indy, offered to resign. Those managers then reported the incident to Nolintha, who waited 2 weeks before calling an all-staff Bidamanda meeting, at which Shields apologized and wept profusely, and Nolintha announced she would resign. It was an uncomfortable afternoon. Employees say that its bungled handling reflects deeper issues at the restaurant. Dye says of Nolintha, "He positioned himself to be so influential in the community. When you have that combination of wealth, power, and influence, I could see how you feel invincible, like nobody's going to speak out against me, and if they do, nothing will be done about it." In response to written questions from the Indy, a spokesman for Nolintha issued the following statement, quote, excuse me, "Van has stepped down as a managing partner and is no longer involved in the operation of the restaurants. He has started the process of divesting his ownership, which is complicated and will take time. It would be inappropriate to comment further." Parks told the Indy, "I don't think any of this would have come out without the pandemic and Black Lives Matter protests. It was definitely the perfect storm. Van is the golden boy with perfectly crafted social media. After all, this is kind of like finding out how magic works." The next section, called Culture of Coercion. Before this, if you Googled Van Nolintha, you encounter a wealth of effusive results. There were profiles and interviews, lush images of foamy beer and sky blue pools. One of the first search results on the North Carolina Leadership Council website outlined Nolintha's journey to opening one of the first Laotian restaurants in the country. Van and Vanvisa Nolintha moved from Laos to Greensboro in 1998 and 99, respectively, when they were both around 11 or 12 years old. They lived with family friends until they graduated from high school there. Nolintha attended NC State University, where he was admitted into the prestigious Caldwell Fellows Program and traveled widely before pursuing graduate studies in community building and the role of art and design in the peacemaking process at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. These interests were reflected in Nolintha's seemingly progressive approach to restaurant management. Bidamanda, located on Blunt Street, opened in 2012. As Nolintha told Forbes in a 2019 oral history, he had graduated Trinity mid-recession and was having trouble finding a job. While visiting his parents in Laos, he decided he wanted to find a way to honor them. When Nolintha returned to Raleigh, he emailed acclaimed chef and restaurateur Ashley Christensen, who offered to help him establish a restaurant. More industry support followed from the likes of Angela Salamanca, owner of Centro, and Trophy Brewing co-owners Chris Powers. A coalition of friends reportedly spent 750 hours helping Nolintha put the restaurant together. The name Bidamanda comes from the Sanskrit ceremonial term for father and mother, according to the restaurant's website, and a focus on family is paramount in the company. Pictures of the Nolintha parents meet your eyes at the entrance of the 22-table restaurant, and a biography of the Nolintha siblings is printed on the first page of each menu. While it is common for restaurants to emphasize family when trying to define their work culture for employees at Bidamanda, this emphasis was more pronounced. Taylor Quinn, who was hired as a server at Bidamanda in March 2017 and worked through the summer of 2018, says, "I went in with this mindset, like these are magical people. At the time, I thought it was so cool they were so story-based, and they brought another element to dining." Nearly everyone in the restaurant's management had close relationship with the Nolinthas or reflected their values in family ties. There were Jordan and Hester and his brother Casey, who both worked as managers. Siblings Deanna and Elizabeth Nguyen also worked in management and are longtime family friends of the Nolinthas. Several other managers, including Luisa Amarillo, knew Nolintha from the Caldwell Fellows Leadership Development Program at NC State. The sprawling, elegant brewery Bavana opened in 2017, bringing in a third partner, Patrick Woodson, who also oversaw operation at the nearby brewery. Woodson is the son of NC State Chancellor Randy Woodson. The name for the multi-concept space, which includes a flower shop, bookstore, and brewery, translates to cultivation. The company grew quickly. By the time the coronavirus shutdown closed the restaurants in April, the two restaurants collectively employed 211 people. Sarah Dye, the woman whose question proved the catalyst for all the upheaval at the restaurants, applied for a job at Brewery Bavana in 2018 after moving to Raleigh from San Francisco. By then, the restaurant had amassed glowing write-ups in virtually all local publications, including the Indy, and in national outlets of Bon Appetit. In 2017, Forbes went so far as to anoint Bavana as one of the 10 coolest places to eat in 2018. Writing that the restaurant had completed the capital city's transformation from an underachieving food town to a serious eating destination. The following spring, Brewery Bavana was named a semi-finalist for a James Beard Award in the category Best New Restaurant in the Country. When Dye came in to interview, she says she found herself overwhelmed by the airy, open beauty of the space. Ornamental flowers, bamboo baskets of dim sum, potted fig trees that reached towards orbs of light. The application process she underwent was different from others she'd experienced. For one thing, Nolenta didn't seem to care about her CV. He wanted to learn about her. Dye says they made it sound like they were looking for someone really specific. They didn't want you to just have retail or book experience. They wanted something more personal. It was an attractive place to work. The money was good, better than at most places. There was an electricity and edge to working for two of the most celebrated restaurants in North Carolina. And as employees have repeatedly stated, the restaurants could feel like a big family. Emotional openness was a quality particularly valued in prospective workers. Although his was a high-end restaurant, Nolinda frequently sought out young people without prior industry experience for front-of-house work. This, employees say, made it easier for him to shape them to fit in with his restaurant's untraditional practices. There was, in other words, a type. And when someone didn't fit that social mold, employees say that too was made clear by management. Bartender Patricia Heath, who was hired in 2014, says, I was an outlier because I was older. I'm 35 now. Every manager was younger than me, except for Jordan Hester. And I wasn't straight out of school. I was familiar with the area. I had different social circles. A 37-page employee handbook acquired by the Indy includes detailed instructions on what to wear, how to greet guests, and how to handle conflict. Toward the back of the manual, a 2-page section notes that sexual harassment is unlawful. Rather than discouraging hierarchical relationships between supervisors and staff, however, the manual says such relationships could not involve job leverage. It read, no supervisor or manager shall suggest that an applicant or employee's acquiescence to sexual advances may favorably affect his or her conditions of employment or career development. The list of required reading materials on the Nolinda family, history, beer culture, and the floral arts were extensive. But as those materials made clear, working at the restaurant was a special opportunity to work in an intentional community. Dye was hired to manage the bookshop and found herself encouraged to promote envelope-pushing works like Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, Rebecca Traister's Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Woman's Anger, and Free Women, Free Men by Camille Paglia. Whether guests would buy Dye's selections didn't seem to be the point. The books, she was told, were more of a statement piece. They told a story. Dye was also struck by the restaurant's proximity to power. Early on at the restaurant's glitzy annual fundraiser, Bida Promda, she remembers Nolinda grabbing her arm as she walked past and pulling her towards him. Get a wine for the First Lady, please, he said, according to Dye. Dye was startled when she looked up and saw Governor Roy Cooper and his wife, Kristen. It was her first introduction to the powerful circles the Nolinthas ran in, which included Raleigh power brokers, like Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin and former Mayor Nancy McFarlane, City Council members Jonathan Melton, Nicole Stewart, developers like John Cooper and Greg Hatem, socialites like Eliza Kraft, and restaurant luminaries like Chidi Kumar, Salamanca, and Christensen. In addition to serving on prominent local boards, Nolinda also was celebrated by national figures like John T. Edge, director of the Southern Foodways Alliance. The company culture at Brewery Bavana was also different from others Di had experienced. Closer, looser, more physical. In interviews with the Indy, employees emphasized how physical Nolinda and the other managers were toward employees. While on the job, there were frequent massages. Multiple employees used the word encouraged to describe management's stance on staff dating. It was common for managers to make sexual comments about staff. Brandon Edwards, who worked as a host server and graphic designer at Beatamana between 2016 and 2019, says, "You probably weren't going to get the same attention from management or praise at all if you weren't giving into vulnerability and being open and emotional at all times. My introduction to that world was a staff retreat I went on where it was crying around the clock because it's lots of intimate storytelling. Of course, there was alcohol at all times, so that was fueled. I remember crying at the retreat and being like, I'm never open like this. I don't usually do this kind of thing." The Beatamanda staff retreats were not mandatory, although employees tell the Indy they felt there would be repercussions if they didn't attend. Retreats consisted of drinking and cooking, drinking and talking, and drinking and trust-building exercise. Former bartender Heath says every single person cried at least once a retreat. Manager Whitney Houston and Jordan Hester would deliberate for a long time about which groups they would put you into, and then they would ask you questions. And then they'd have these questions and so much alcohol. It's like what cults do. They wear you down. They were probing group questions. What was your most vulnerable moment? There were jokes about consent, including, oh no, we're going to get sued. It was always angled like you would enjoy your time more if you did what the family wanted to do, which was to be honest and open and emotional, Edwards says. Back in Raleigh, karaoke was a popular activity for staff. After shifts, a group would often head to Flex on Southwest Street for long nights of singing and drinking. Sometimes managers, including Nolinda, would come along. Socializing off the clock wasn't formally required, but many workers, especially new probationary ones, said they felt pressured to participate. Taylor Quinn, who says, if you weren't going to be all the way in the culture and drink the Kool-Aid, you wouldn't be hired in one of the best restaurants in Raleigh. She heard managers disparaging employees who wanted to, quote, just leave after their shift. Extracurricular drinking often turned to touching. There was lots of, like, grabbing people's hands and saying, let's take shots, says Di of Evenings Out. That's very popular with Van, and it's always multiple. It's not one random shot. It's multiple rounds of shot, and he always pays for everything. That was my first introduction to his vibrant, big personality, and what I thought for a long time was generosity. Now, I don't see it as generosity. When that generosity was most needed, employees say it could be unevenly applied. Alex Shoemaker was hired as a bartender at Beatamanda in 2013. Less than a year into the job, Shoemaker's girlfriend miscarried. She was several months into pregnancy, and Shoemaker was devastated. He says, I had a pretty big breakdown. I missed a couple days of work, and I communicated this with Van at the time. He didn't really seem all that compassionate about the situation, which was funny to me, coming from a guy who had talked about being compassionate to one another and trying to understand other people's lives and the obstacles they'd overcome. In retrospect, Shoemaker describes the restaurant as a cult of personality. At the time, though, he says he was thrilled to work with a cocktail visionary like Jordan Hester and felt that he'd stumbled into a transformative community. The week after his breakdown, Shoemaker says Nolinda called and told him they needed to have a conversation. Shoemaker had been warned about his boss's tendency to suddenly let employers go. Still, he was shocked by Nolinda's tone. I closed on Monday, and he helped me close, and after, he fired me. I asked him what I had done wrong, Shoemaker says. His response to me was that, quote, the light in my eyes had gone out. Shoemaker moved away from North Carolina shortly thereafter. He says, you feel like you're cast out. Your entire life is wrapped up in that community. All my friends worked there. When I lost my job, I lost my entire support group. It felt like people were told not to talk to me. At a gathering at a co-worker's home in 2015, Helen Flowers, a server who briefly worked at Vitamonda, recalls someone turning on a video recording of staff singing karaoke. She says she was surprised by the physicality captured in the images on screen. She says in one of the videos, Van was kissing one of the servers. It was so weird, and I mentioned something like, oh, I didn't know that was a thing. And the person I was talking to, she said, everyone has made out with Van. Brandon Edwards began working at Vitamonda in 2016 when he was 21. He soon noticed Nolintha taking an interest in him and shortly thereafter began to receive suggestive text messages from his boss, including one that, according to Edwards, intimated that if the two had sex, Nolintha would be the one on top since he was the boss. One night, Nolintha invited him to have an after-hours drink at the restaurant, and the two went upstairs to the apartment where Nolintha lived at the time. They made out, and Nolintha put his hand on his crotch, Edwards says, before Nolintha sent him home. And while his boss's attentions eventually wore off, Edwards said that the dynamic made for an unsettling, confusing work experience. Justin Moretto, who worked as a bartender at Brewery Bavana in 2017, says he experienced numerous uncomfortable moments with Nolintha. His boss would compliment his appearance, he says. Once, while Moretto was behind a bar, he asked him to take his shirt off. Later that night, Nolintha rubbed Moretto's shoulder as he was using the urinal. When Moretto mentioned the harassment to a manager, he says that he was rebuked and shortly thereafter let go. Phillips Ayers, a bartender, was part of the original staff at Brewery Bavana. He recalls an instance when he and Nolintha were both in the men's bathroom. His boss drew Ayers' attention to the stylish room's design, noting, according to Ayers, that it exposed the people using it from certain angles. He says, it was weird to have the owner point out and laugh about it. All we're taught with guests is you've got to protect them, to do everything you can to take care of them and make them feel comfortable. Bavana was often referred to as the living room of Raleigh. That seems to not line up. It's really inappropriate if you know about that and don't fix it. Ayers added that he mentioned his discomfort with the bathroom design to Woodson, who, Ayers said, laughed it off. A spokesman for the company says the restaurant bathrooms meet all standards of sanitation and privacy. One male employee, who asked not to be named, lists numerous instances in which Nolintha acted inappropriately, coming up behind him at the urinals and touching him or groping him aggressively at a party once. During one evening out, the employee says he had refused drinks from Nolintha multiple times, only to find Nolintha pouring a drink in his face as he clenched his mouth shut, alcohol running over his mouth and down his shirt. That same employee had been warned early about Nolintha's attention toward young male workers. After these encounters, he says he went out of his way to avoid his boss. Later, during a performance review, an evaluation caught him off guard. He was, in his manager's word, not vulnerable enough. One evening in July of 2018, Di was working at the bookstore when she took a break to place a takeout order at Vitamonda. While there, another staff member was escorting an intoxicated server out the door. Di jumped in to help him bring the employee outside and waited with him till his Uber arrived. The employee groped Di several times despite her repeated protests. As soon as his car arrived, Di says that she went to Nolintha to report her discomfort with the encounter. He assured her it would be dealt with. Then he asked her not to tell anyone. The next day, Di received an apology text from the server who had groped her. This unsettled her. She hadn't given Nolintha permission to give out her phone number. She was also put off by the language Nolintha used to describe his conversation with the employee, which seemed to amount more to a heart-to-heart than disciplinary action. Nolintha texted Di in a message she shared with Indy. It was really powerful, he texted. He was really upset with himself, but I assured him that we know who he is, but that doesn't take away from the need to address what happened. In addition to the sexual harassment, workers say they experienced from manager, the company was harboring an accused sexual predator, Jordan Hester. For Dai, the incident with a drunken co-worker made her more aware of the restaurant's patchwork HR process, which was unwieldy at best for a company that employed more than 200 people. For several other women, Hester's treatment at the company drove that point home. Over the years, his name has traveled among the whisper networks of Raleigh's hospitality industry. Despite his public claims that he hired women bartenders to give them a leg up in the cocktail world, employees say Hester routinely upbraided and demeaned them. The Indy spoke with several female bartenders who left the restaurants and derailed their careers at the restaurants because of him. Dai began to advocate for better reporting systems at the company. As a department head, she reported directly to Nolinda, but says that because she was one of the only managers not to have had a prior personal relationship with him, she did not feel protected. The sentiment against upper management was not all negative. In early June, manager Sarah Yap and flower shop creative Diana Nguyen both wrote statements in support of staff, and employees say they felt some managers, including Van Visa Nolinta, maintained professional conduct. Patricia Heath says, I don't want to say anything about Van Visa besides the fact I think she's a good manager and I like and respect her. I think she and her brother have had their own different relationship and whole other power thing going on there with Van having more power over that relationship. Nevertheless, reporting to upper management could be fraught, and employees say there was not clear pathways for addressing issues. Most managers had long-standing loyalties to Linta or porous boundaries with staff. Jessica recounted how manager Luisa Jaramillo would often yell at her, then quickly flip to effusive praise and physical touch. The Indy reached out multiple times to Jaramillo, who did not want to comment, and Whitney Wilson, who never replied. Jibril Parks, the employee who was called a slave, says he isn't one to rock the boat. A laid-back musician, Parks said his frustration with the February incident was exacerbated by the fact that he felt his hands were tied. Norlintha, whom employees recall saying that he didn't see color, took several weeks before involving the entire staff in an attempt to resolve the matter. Employees say there were no black staff in positions of management and that it was rare for black front-of-house staff to be hired. Parks says, Kate called me a slave, and then it's like, damn, am I a slave to my circumstances? Because I can't even quit. I've got bills. As much as I'd like to pack my bags and go, I wasn't in a financial situation either way, where that was a realistic option. Several employees recounted instances where Nolinda discouraged them from pursuing outside employees opportunities or going back to school. They worried crossing him would jeopardize other job opportunities in Raleigh. No one wanted to find themselves several years out of college and blacklisted with no other career experience. Lindsay, the employee mentioned in the sidebar, which I won't have time to read, once you were in, you were in. It was so much more than a job. It was a way of life. And if you didn't feel it or buy into it, you were out. Van had such a mystical way about him, and his story and teachings were so moving. He was a moral and ethical pillar of the downtown Raleigh community, and his reach was growing fast. We literally used to joke about being in the Beta cult. Though the corporate company emphasized vulnerability and empathy, those qualities did not seem to be rewarded in an HR context. One employee, a rape survivor, recounts feeling jolted when on her way to serve guests she walked past a whiteboard with a rape joke scrawled about it. When she told the manager she was upset, the complaint turned into two separate meetings with managers, one of which dragged late into the night and involving Jaramillo's grilling her on her sexual trauma and concluding that the employee hadn't gotten over it. In December of 2018, Dai sent an email to management detailing her frustrations with a beer club the restaurant ran, with suggestions for a more streamlined process. A few days later, Nolinda asked her to come in early to work. I showed up, she says, and he fired me pretty much on the spot. And he said that the reason was my email threw the brewery under the bus, and there was no coming back for that for me. I just remember thinking the whole time, a man groped me and still works here. On June 9th, Nolinda announced he was stepping away from the company permanently and would begin the process of ending his financial interest in Bidamanda and Brewery Bivana. That same day, a restaurant spokesperson announced Jordan Hester no longer worked with the company. Shortly after, Jaramillo and Wilson also resigned. Denise Klein, a high-profile Raleigh employment lawyer, was brought in to investigate allegations of misconduct. Woodson wrote in an email to employees that the company intended to use Klein's finding to implement change, while acknowledging that many staff members had questioned Klein's impartiality due to the fact that she had been hired by the restaurant. Klein wrapped up her work in 2 weeks. All employees who were sources for this article said they declined to speak to Klein. When pressed by the India on July 23rd, Van Viesen, Nolinda, and Woodson stated that for reasons of confidentiality, they cannot disclose Klein's findings. But the email adds, many of the management, policy, and HR enhancements we are considering are direct result of the feedback we received from the investigation. In the wake of the scandal, Patrick Woodson has distanced himself, saying he was not privy to daily on-site operations. Several employees who spoke to the Indy say, though, that Woodson was frequently made aware of employee concerns. Woodson wrote in the restaurant memo to the Indy, I was told at a manager's meeting almost 2 years ago that the company had hired an HR consultant, and I am aware of instances in the restaurant for which the consultant's advice was sought. Van Visa, for her part, has been quiet about how aware she was of issues in the restaurants. Many of the employees the Indy interview say they do not hold her personally responsible, as her brother has been the public face of the company and primarily handled decisions over the years. And I see that this article is so long and detailed that I've run out of time to finish reading it. I do hope you've enjoyed listening to this week's article of the Indy Week. And be sure to listen next time. I'm John Feddersen, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And the Indy Week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, give us a call, please, 919-832-5138. Once again, 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and we'll be back with you in a week with another reading of Indy Week.